Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me again this week. On this episode, we're looking at a superb courtroom drama, Anatomy of a Murder, a film made in 1959, starring James Stewart, amongst others, and directed by Otto Preminger. So we're going to take Anatomy of a Murder and put it under the legal microscope, as it were. And joining me to do this is none other than criminal defence lawyer Kathy Glinski. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Carl.
Yeah, so long-term listeners of the podcast will remember that, we talked about 12 Angry Men, didn't we, last year? But the strange thing about 12 Angry Men, it's one of the landmark kind of legal films, but you don't really see very much of the courtroom, so I was always kind of keen to get you back on to talk about some lawyers, you know.
Yeah, very cool.
I think you might have alluded to this on the previous podcast. I'm not quite sure. I can't quite remember. But is Anatomy of a Murder quite a significant film for you? Is it one that had, like, a big impact? Is that right?
I don't think I discovered it till after I was a lawyer. But it is really the best courtroom movie I've ever seen. So it has an impact that way. And it also sort of features the defense attorney, which is what I do. So I really like, you know, yeah, we're the hero. Yeah. Doesn't happen all the time.
Yeah. And, you know, played by one of the great kind of stars of, like, you know, of Hollywood of all time, really, in James
exactly.
Stewart. But, like, so why is this, like, the best then? Because I suppose, like 12 Angry Men, there are things this film doesn't do. Like, it doesn't show as flashbacks. There's quite a lot of ambiguity. It's kind of realistic as well, isn't it? I believe it's kind of shot in real locations, shot in a real courtroom and stuff like that. So is that the kind of thing you mean about why it's so good?
It's very realistic. It presents evidence in the way that it's presented for real. There are real rulings that the attorneys have to deal with and get around, and they have to, you know, they don't get to just bring in any evidence they want. They have to prove that it's relevant to this trial. So procedurally, it's good. Just the way it's presented is very realistic. There's obviously some dramatic license in there. It's over the top. I think what makes it so realistic, though, is it was written by a judge who was writing about a case that he did as defense attorney. So they just get it right. Yeah.
And it's actually quite stylish as well, isn't it? Like, I really like the score. I've actually got a CD box set of, like, jazz film scores. And this is by Duke Ellington, of course. So he actually appears in the film as well. In one scene.
Yeah, that was a fun scene.
Yeah. And, I mean, I never get to play that CD because I'm, like, the only person in this house who enjoys jazz, to be honest. But yeah, you enjoy the music, Kathy, or what?
I like it in this movie. I don't know that I would listen to it otherwise. I'm not really a jazz person, yeah.
So just before we come on to, like, the legal kind of intricacies or whatever. Yeah, so, I mean, very well-acted film. We said Jimmy Stewart, but, you know, Lee Remick's really good. Ben Gazzara, all the people, really. Eve Arden, George C. Scott as the as dancer.
Yeah.
James Stewart, though, are you a fan? I mean, he's one of those figures that I sort of assume everybody must be.
He's my favorite actor. I will watch his movies all day long. He's so good.
Yeah.
There's just something so incredibly likable about him, even when he's not necessarily a likable character, that just makes me want to listen to him and watch him.
Yeah, well, you say the voice, I think, is a big part of it. And yeah, and the thing about not necessarily being likable perhaps applies to this film. We shall see. So,
I like him.
Well, I think maybe that's the defense attorney speaking.
Maybe.
You know. Right, so yeah, we're going to go through, we're going to sort of see what this film kind of says about the legal system, what it kind of, how it presents it. Let me just give a very quick plot synopsis. I hope everybody listening has seen this film. Maybe not, but in sum, it's, you know, James Stewart's character, Paul, takes on the case of a man called Frederick Mannion, played by Ben Gazzara, who's been arrested for the first degree murder of an innkeeper. Mannion kind of claims he raped his wife, Laura, played by Lee Remick. Eventually, the case goes to trial. I don't want to say too much more because we'll go through some of the kind of developments. There are plenty of them in the kind of 2.5 hour running time. It's a while actually there before we get to the courtroom, isn't it? So when we meet Stewart's character, Paul, it seems like he's kind of semi-retired or something. Now, they say he was beat out of the Office of Public Prosecutor. So let me just check I understand this. So what does that mean? Was he voted out? Was he kind of maneuvered out? Oh, voted out, yeah.
In lots of jurisdictions, it's an elected office. And so that was what they're saying. This he had been prosecutor for a long time, and then he just lost the election to Mitch Lodwig. So he's suddenly finding himself not prosecuting cases anymore and having to do a different kind of law practice, and he'd rather be fishing.
Yeah. I've never understood this thing. I know you kind of elect judges and you elect public prosecutors, and it seems to me like the things needed to win an election aren't always the same things that are, like, you know, best for the rule of law. You know, you can imagine an election where being really tough on crime or whatever is going to get you over the line. Is it really a problem, though? I don't know. You will obviously know better than me.
Well, they're supposed to be nonpartisan offices that they're running for, but it really is a strange system because most voters don't know anything about what a prosecutor or a judge really does. And so to put it in the hands of the voters is kind of strange. Although the head prosecutor is elected, the deputies who work for him are, you know, they're just career attorneys. So there's not that much changeover if there happens to be a change in the prosecutor's office. You still have experienced attorneys running the show. But yeah, it can be an issue, especially the tough on crime doesn't necessarily lead to the best law or the best actions by the state.
Okay, so like you kind of mentioned before, it seems like, you know, he's kind of happy fishing and stuff like this.
Yeah.
But then when he actually gets wind of his case and obviously decides to take it on, it does seem like he gets kind of absorbed in it. I think we see him at one point, he's kind of reading something to do with the case. And he seems like his attention's entirely fixed on it. He's really caught up in it. Is that your experience that, you know, a case can become kind of all-consuming?
Yeah, it can, especially one as notorious as this one would have been. I think that's one of the things Paul's looking at, is like, this is my way to show I'm still here, I'm still relevant, I'm still in the thick of things. It's also just the most interesting thing that's happened in that little neck of the woods in a while. So, I could think he'd really be caught up in it.
Yeah, so there's all these early scenes where we're sort of sizing up what the case is about. And at one point when it's being discussed, there's a reference to the fact that the unwritten law, whatever that is a myth. So I can kind of surmise what it is from the context of the drama, I think. But what exactly is, like, the unwritten law?
Well, it would be like the notion of playing on the jury's sympathy as well. If a man rapes your wife, you get to kill him. That would be the unwritten law. Anything that, you know, everyone knows he deserved killing anyway, so let's not convict you of murder even though you murdered him. And it is a myth. I mean, although it's not as much a myth. I mean, it's definitely jurors are, you know, lawyers try to play on those sympathies all the time. They try to get the jury to like the client or hate the defendant or whatever, just because that's there. It's just human nature.
Yeah, so like, the way this case kind of presents early on then, so how does it seem to you? Because I think at one point it's described by one of the characters as like open and shut. So is that your assessment? That's kind of how it seems at first glance anyway?
Well, yeah. I mean, Mannion's behavior wasn't in the heat of the moment. It, you know, you really have to try to stretch it to justify what he did or excuse what he did. So and there's never any question that he shot Barney Quill. So in that sense, it was, it's open and shut. He shot Barney Quill and he's not denying it. No one's denying it. So for a prosecutor, it's an open and shut case. Yeah.
So what then would be like the appeal to a lawyer of taking on an open and shut case if they didn't have to? I mean, I know there's obviously lawyers who are appointed to cases and things like that, but obviously it doesn't apply in this story.
Right. Well, and I think that was really clear to Paul. I mean, he wasn't going to immediately take this case. He had to interview Mannion and he had to interview Laura.
Yeah.
He really wanted to make sure there was something he could do to win, that there was a story he could tell, that there was going to be some way to justify this action. And that would be the draw, is to find this challenge, this legal challenge, and especially once they came up with a hook to see if he could convince the jury of that.
Yeah, because he has kind of like a eureka moment later where they find something in the law book, don't they? Kind of some kind of precedent that they're going to kind of hang the case on or whatever. But like he says, like, they don't immediately hit it off, of course. And he says, like, I'm not the right lawyer for this fella. He's insolent, hostile. So yeah, how important is it, like, the rapport between a lawyer and a client? Because obviously it is a weird situation, I guess, where you have to spend a bit of time with somebody in a quite artificial kind of circumstance, as it were. So I guess it must be quite important.
Yeah, I love that when Parnell tells him, you don't have to love him, you just have to defend him,
Yeah.
because that's just very true. And for me, I'm court appointed, so I never get a choice of who my clients are, like Paul does. But it's just a very real situation. You don't have to like the client. It's your job to provide zealous advocacy. So even if you don't like him and you don't believe him, he still has a right to a trial, and he still has a right to an attorney who's going to do the best he can for him. So it's a tough balance, but it's one that's very real and it's always there. And I just loved the fact that they were acknowledging that in this movie, because Paul clearly doesn't like Mannion, and probably rightfully so, but he still can defend him and do it well.
So Paul and Mannion are together, and I think he says like there are four ways he can defend a murder charge. I can't remember all of what he said, but all this stuff sounded pretty sound to you, I assume.
Either you didn't do it didn't happen, either, or you were justified or you were excused.
So there's this really fascinating scene where it's like, it seems to me like he's kind of leading Mannion to a certain conclusion implicitly. He doesn't say anything amiss necessarily.
He's very careful to make it seem like he's not coaching, but that's exactly what he's doing. And he even gets offended when Mannion says, "Am I getting warmer?" So maybe he's just uncomfortable with the role of being a defense attorney. But he's clearly, I mean, that's the only way he's going to win this case is if he can come up with one of those four defenses.
Yeah, but like, so the thing is though, wouldn't Mannion's version of events, as it were, have been different if Paul had not kind of prodded him in the right direction like that? So even the scene ends where he says, like, remember how crazy you were, but is it not unethical? Or does he kind of walk the line just about kind of thing? I don't know.
I don't have to deal with this because I'm not the trial attorney. But yeah, no, it's really tough because I think in this scene he's doing, I would not be comfortable with doing what Paul is doing in this scene. And I don't know how much it goes on. Maybe I'm just naive, but I don't represent clients at trial. I do their appeals once this has already been done. But yeah, I think Paul is clearly coaching Mannion, and even the thing, well, I must have been mad. Oh no, anger doesn't do it. No, I'm crazy. I'm crazy. So he's clearly coaching him into this. The only way I can get you off is if one of these happens. So tell me a story that where one of these things happened. But then Mannion is able to go to a psychiatrist and get a diagnosis. So maybe, I don't know. I think it's coaching, and I think Mannion's coming up with that story. In that moment, I don't think it existed until Paul suggested it.
Yeah, now I haven't read the book the film is based on. I don't know if you have.
Yeah, I have. A long time ago.
Well, what I've read online is that one of the key differences is that in the book, Paul actually kind of suggests insanity as the defense a bit more, you know. So maybe it's been changed slightly for the film. But I guess it kind of goes back to like what we were saying a bit with 12 Angry Men, I think, that, you know, there are all these rules about how the jury conducts themselves, but it kind of happens behind closed doors, doesn't it? And this does too, doesn't it? How can you police this kind of thing? Because it happens
Oh,
in,
you can. I mean, lawyers have rules that they are ethically obligated to follow, but a client and lawyer conversation is confidential. No one can inquire into that. So there's no way to police it. You just have to rely on the ethics of the attorney.
Now, I wanted to get your take on the character of Laura, really, because I think the way the film treats her is really interesting. And like one of the things that keeps coming up like throughout the film is like how attractive she is in like the eyes of all these male characters. And I don't know, I'm not sure if like the trauma like she's undergone is adequately addressed kind of thing, but maybe that's reflective of like the shortcomings of the time as well. But I don't know what you think.
I actually thought that they did better for the time than I would expect, and better than other movies did. But you're right, she's moved on for something so traumatic happening to her. But I think that when she's telling Paul her story, I think it's done very effectively. She's really just telling what happened, and she was clearly traumatized by it, and she's very believable, and she's in contrast to when Mannion's coming up with his defense, she's just telling what happened. She's giving the facts. She's relating it as it happened, not coming up with it in the moment. And she still had the black eye, although there could have been another source for that. But yeah, I really like that interview with in Paul's office, because where he's sizing her up and trying to see what the jury will think of her, see if her story will hold up. And, you know, he challenges her on the facts, and she doesn't try to lie. She says, well, I don't know why this is different. It's just the dog was in the car and then he was out of the car, you know. Yeah. So she's not getting tripped up. She's very believable. And frankly, the stuff she's saying is really shocking and frank for a movie of that time. So that was just really impressive to me.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the most fascinating things about the film, I think, is like the use of language, and it's quite charged, and especially for 1959. So yeah, not just that like rape is talked about, but also, you know, words like sperm and bitch and panties come up, and they get a few good laughs out of it, I thought. Like, I actually enjoyed the scene where they're trying to find a more acceptable word than panties, and somebody says, like, I know a French word, but it's quite suggestive, and the reply comes back, you know, most French words are, you know. But one of the things is that, like, when you've got the onlookers in the court, you know, and they find some of this language amusing, and the judge kind of says, you know, get over it, you know.
Yeah, oh, I love that from the judge. There's nothing amusing about a pair of panties that figures in the violent death of one man and the possible incarceration of another. That was just such a perfect little speech right there.
So I was wondering, like, you know, things like explicit language or like really tough, uncomfortable subject matter, you know, are there kind of issues with discussing this in court? And I think you do see, like, obviously, as we've discussed, it kind of is addressed in this film as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I think every once in a while you get witnesses who try to clean up the language as they're testifying, and they have to be reminded, no, just tell us what was said. And then other times you get witnesses who don't ever see a need to censor themselves. What you get in this movie is a very sanitized version of what you would read or see in a courtroom now, talking about the subject matter. You have to be very explicit, because you can't have the jury speculating or drawing inferences. You really want them to know what actually happened, and it can get really uncomfortable.
Yeah, so I suppose, but like for the time, this is like really, really frank in terms of like a film.
Yes. And, if for a film, this was shocking. Yeah.
And even, I don't know if you read this, but apparently James Stewart's father, like, took out newspaper adverts telling people not to go and see this dirty film his son had made and stuff like that.
No way. Yeah. Wow.
Which I thought was incredible. And I hope that story is true, because it's just good stuff. But I mean, you've got this frankness, but then you've also got, so it seems to kind of contrast with some of the ceremonial stuff you get in court, you know, like you stand up when the judge arrives, Your Honor, you address him as Your Honor, and some of the language that's used. And I don't know, I think I've never been in a courtroom myself. They seem a bit archaic to an outsider sometimes, but like, is it kind of important that these kind of traditions are sort of upheld, or what?
It adds gravity to what you're doing, you know, that you have to follow these steps. And, I mean, when the prosecutor was reading the charge, that always strikes me as really strange, because it's strange language, the way the charge is written and then reading in the courtroom. And but I think it really does, it just highlights how important this moment is. We're not taking this lightly. We're going to do this, and we're going to do it right, and we're going to do it in the right way.
Yeah. All right, so what about the figure of the judge? So he's played by a guy called Joseph N. Welch, who, I mean, I only just learned this myself, but in real life he was a lawyer for the army. He was kind of famous for kind of slapping down Joseph McCarthy during the McCarthy hearings, and he says, like, do you have no sense of decency, sir, or something like that. I mean, I thought the actor's really good. And the way he handled the case and everything seemed good as well.
Yeah, he's just so funny and so real. He's portrayed this sense of gravity. This is an important thing we're doing, but we can have some sense of humor as we're doing it. I love the way he admonished the lawyers when they were getting out of hand. You know, he wasn't easily swayed one side or the other. He was very fair, but he was funny. I love the part at the arraignment when Mannion was off seeing the psychiatrist, and the judge is dressing him down. Well, I don't know. I didn't expect you to do it this way. We don't do it this way where I come from. But, Paul is just sort of tickled by him. He just smiles, because he knows it's a deserving comment, but he appreciates the judge's humor about it. Yeah, I thought that actor was really good. Just enjoyable. I wanted to be in his courtroom.
Yes, I mean, there are plenty of characters in this film that deserve a mention. So, like, Paul's got his own little team, it looks like, you know. So, Parnell McCarthy's the guy with the drinking problem, yeah. Played by Arthur O'Connell. And Maida Rutledge is played by Eve Arden. So, yeah, there's that scene, I think, Paul, like, tells McCarthy that he needs him. You know, I wonder if this thing about the alcoholic lawyer seems a bit of a trope, because I've seen it seem to us in a few films where that's the case. And I think we mentioned The Verdict with Paul Newman last time.
Yeah.
That's a great example of it, though. But what about this thing, this importance of having, like, dependable, kind of steadfast colleagues, I suppose, in reality, but also, like, they make a good little unit in the film, I think.
It does. It makes for a nice touch in the movie, because they can show the investigation going on while the trial is going on, and they have, you know, little ways to bring those facts in. And, you know, most defense attorneys do have investigators on their team. So it's realistic in a way. I think the drunk lawyer who's suddenly cured by the end of his alcoholism is a little silly or unrealistic, we'll put it that way. But I do love Parnell McCarthy. I thought he was a great addition to the movie. So
yeah, so I think I kind of mentioned this moment earlier, but so they hit the law books and they unearth this whatever it is, the favorable legal precedent that's going to help them out, kind of eureka moment.
Irresistible. Can I tell you a fun fact? When I started in the law, that's exactly how I had to do it. I had to go to the county law library and look up books. I did not have an internet account to do my legal searches. Isn't that shocking?
Well, this is what I was going to ask you is, these days, what, you just ask Siri or something? I don't know.
Well, no, there are legal research programs which are amazing. They can compile all of law, and you can search it. And, I mean, it's improving all the time. And Westlaw existed when I went to law school, but no one could afford it. You know, big firms had it, but the rest of us were hauling our cookies to the county law library.
So what does that mean in practice? It just kind of frees up a lot of time that...
Oh, yeah. And it's much more efficient to search with a search engine than just try to look up, you know. It's more like guesswork when you're doing it with the books, because you have to say, well, I'm going to see, maybe I'll try this word, and then so you look up this word and it'll point you to a few cases, but you're not necessarily going to automatically find everything that talks about it. So yeah, internet research programs are much more efficient.
Yeah, good stuff. So a scene I really like is, it comes when, like, Mannion is quite agitated when his wife hasn't been to see him in whatever it is, 2 days or something. And Paul's like, yeah, I'll get in touch with her. I'll tell her you miss her and all this. So I just thought it was interesting. He has to kind of, in addition to, he's got to kind of defend him, of course, but he has to take on this kind of, it's like a pastoral role. He's kind of supportive, isn't he? He's got to do all that as well. So
yeah.
I guess it's not necessarily in the job description, but there are all these things that kind of add to the workload.
Well, he's really managing his case. If his client is upset, it's going to affect his demeanor at trial. It's going to affect her. She's going to be his star witness. He really has to make sure he's on top of what she's doing and how she comes across to the jury. So it's all part of trial strategy, but it is sort of all encompassing things you wouldn't necessarily think of a lawyer needing to do.
Yeah. All right. So the sort of trial itself then. So, I mean, it's often the case, isn't it, in films or in a TV drama, that the relationship between the defense and the prosecution is, like, very adversarial.
Yeah.
And obviously the situation is inherently adversarial. And, you know, the judge, I think, says the court's a field of battle or something.
Right.
But I mean, like, the relationship between the lawyers or whatever. So George C. Scott's character, Dancer.
Yeah.
He's pretty a slippery character in certain ways, but he butts heads with Paul quite a bit in the film, doesn't he? So what did you make of their kind of relationship then?
Yeah, it was a really good touch for the movie. I Dancer is so slimy, you just can't help but hate him, and then Ludwig is clueless, he's a fool, and you can tell this was written by a defense attorney. But I thought Dancer was very interesting, because he's this big wig from the state capitol, and he comes in expecting Paul to be stupid and backwards, and he's clearly not prepared for Paul and how brilliant he is. And I really liked, it went over the top with the bickering and the accusations during trial, but it that made for good drama. it made it really fun. I love them at the very end where Paul says, "Do it again, I'll punch you from here to Lake Michigan or whatever." I think that it's always surprising to find yourself chatting and shaking hands with the attorney across the aisle after the hearing, because you're so adversarial during the trial and during the proceedings, and you're just colleagues basically afterwards. Yeah, but this did a really good job of contrasting the two styles.
So, like, the thing you see, I think, in pretty much every courtroom drama is where something that's been said has to be stricken from the record, and they sort of say here, how can a jury disregard something that's stricken from the record? And it says, well, they can't. So, I mean, that's what I've always wondered is, like, if I'm a juror, I'm sat there, I'm going to remember something significant, whether I've been instructed not to take heed of it or not. But what about the tactic of actually saying something that's going to be kind of ruled inadmissible or whatever? Is that kind of sneaky, or is that just kind of par for the course?
It's no, it's I, Paul definitely went over the line, but that it really is the biggest legal fiction, to telling a jury that they can't, oh, just don't pay attention to that. And but the jury is presumed to follow instructions, and they've been told not to pay attention to it, so then they won't, right? But it's just a fiction that you have to buy into, otherwise you'd never accomplish a trial. It would never get to the end. But there are some things you can't unring the bell sometimes, and that's what Paul is counting on. But I think that this movie definitely showed him going too far with it. But to some extent, it has to. It's there. I mean, it's there in every trial.
As we're speaking about the jury, so we've said that the judge is played by a real life lawyer. So apparently, his wife, he said he'd do the film on the condition that his wife could be one of the jurors. So I'm not sure which one.
But there were women on this jury. It wasn't 12 angry men. I was really pleased to see that.
Yeah, so I can't remember. Did we discuss this last time? Was it a thing where, certain states kind of moved at different speeds in terms of balancing out the juries? I guess it might have been, mightn't it? I don't know.
That could be. And I don't really know, when that happened or if, yeah. It seemed to me like in New York City, they should have been ahead of the time and for 12 angry men, but they weren't.
All right. So, yeah, Jimmy Stewart as a lawyer, as Paul the lawyer. So, I mean, the thing with Stewart, I think, is he's got this kind of folksy image. You think of, like, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington or whatever. So important to his kind of appeal. And it is important here too. I mean, he's always got this dark side as well. It comes out in, like, the Hitchcock films and some of the westerns he made. So as a lawyer, Paul seems like he's very, I mean, the word I want to use is theatrical, He can be very charming. He can also, he seems to get angry, but it seemed to me in quite a performative manner. It seemed like he was kind of under control, but he was kind of playing it up. But how much is, so how important, I mean, this might be something that, this might be an invention of the movies to some extent, but how important is a lawyer's kind of courtroom persona? I mean, do you think it requires a level of performance?
Maybe not quite as much as all big lawyers, but I think so. I think that the jury is, the jury, if the jury doesn't like the lawyer, that they're going to hold it against the client, or that's always the worry. So you have to find a way to either seem very earnest and convincing and you're just trying to seek justice here, or you want the jury to like you and want to like your client. I mean, there's always some kind of performance. You've got to try to be aware of how you're coming across. I loved Jimmy Stewart's portrayal here of the humble country lawyer, just setting himself up as the underdog. And the whole thing is he's more relatable to the jury that way. He's someone they can trust instead of the big shot from Lansing. So I think that's really, to extent, realistic. I don't think we have many Jimmy Stewarts in our courtrooms around the country, but it was fun to see.
And what about the kind of, like, rhetoric that's required? Because I was, it's always like the case in films that the lawyers have a great turn of phrase on hand or whatever. But, like, how much attention do you need to give to, like, crafting, like, the words you're actually using? I mean, I guess not everybody can be as articulate as some of these characters,
That's something that I get really frustrated in when I'm reading transcripts, which is what I do. Just I know what that attorney is trying to ask that witness, and the witness is not understanding it, and the witness is saying something that that's not what they're. And so it's really frustrating that we don't have more articulate attorneys out there. But you know, it's what you do all day, every day. No one's scripting this for you. A lot of it, you're just dealing with it as it comes up, and not everyone's all that articulate off the top of their heads.
Yeah, so like Dancer says at one point, like, Paul must be the most ill-disciplined lawyer he'd ever seen. Like I said, I thought he was in control, but how did you read it? Do you think he, when he lost his rag, he was kind of actually losing it, or do you think it was all part of this performance he was kind of shaping?
Yeah, I don't think he ever lost it. I think everything he did was deliberate.
So, again, one of the kind of tropes, I think, of the courtroom drama is, like, the unexpected thing that's said by a witness. You know, something comes up that leaves one of the lawyers a bit dumbfounded or whatever.
Yeah.
And they don't ask any follow-up questions. I think we see a bit of this, don't we, in the film? I mean, you've just said, haven't you, so it must be so important to be, like, adaptable. You're kind of dealing with stuff that comes up, and you obviously can't prepare it all in advance and kind of game plan every eventuality, I suppose.
That's true. The truth about jury trials is the witnesses are all interviewed before trial, and no one's usually surprised at what's said because they've heard it all before in an interview. And the court has ruled on motions before trial about what evidence is going to come in and what isn't. So there aren't a lot of surprises that actually happen. But every once in a while you get a witness who says something completely different from what they've said before, and you have to deal with it on the spot. But I think that's not very usual.
Yeah. Well, except in film, it seems to have happened in every trial I've ever seen on...
yes, every courtroom movie. Absolutely.
Yeah, so like they have this disagreement, don't they? It's like about whether the rape can be discussed or not.
Yeah.
And the defense is sort of saying like the motive's integral to the fact that the murder was then committed subsequently. I mean, to me, it just seems kind of nonsensical that you couldn't mention that.
Right.
What were they kind of arguing? What was the gist of the argument? Why would they take the view that obviously it's to kind of give the prosecution the best shot or whatever? But
The question for the jury was, did he murder Barney Quill? And these are the elements of murder, and his motive is not an element. And whether she was raped has nothing to do with what he did to Quill. So the jury doesn't have to answer that. But it's crucial to the defense of irresistible impulse, which, you know, they hadn't quite spelled out for the prosecution yet. So the prosecution was just saying it's not relevant at all. The jury doesn't need to know what happened between Barney and Laura, because the question is, did Frederick Mannion shoot Barney Quill? So that was just a fascinating issue. But like I said, that wouldn't have played out in front of the jury. That would have happened before trial. At least that's how we would do it now. So you wouldn't start the jury trial and keep sneaking this stuff in front of the jury. And then, sometimes something comes up at trial and you say, okay, well, now you've opened the door to this evidence. We get to bring the rest in. But this was not a surprise. They knew exactly where they were going. There would have been pretrial motions about it. But the way the court had to listen to the arguments and make the decision was very real. It was, you know, well, is this relevant? Is it not relevant? Prove to me it's relevant. Prove to me we shouldn't bring it in. What struck me, though, was that the prosecutors knew it was relevant because they were coaching their witnesses to talk about, oh, Mannion said his wife had some trouble with Quill, instead of, you know, saying what he actually said was, Barney Quill raped my wife. Yeah. So they knew that the rape was relevant in some extent, and they were trying to keep it out just as much as the defense was trying to get it in.
You know what? I'm starting to like those prosecutors even less, you know, the more we talk.
See, they're slimy.
So I thought it was interesting that there were some things we perhaps didn't see that we might have. So once the trial started, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, because, you know, I might have missed this while I was taking notes, but I don't think we see Paul kind of prepping Mannion for his testimony, for example, do we, after the trial has started, you know?
No, we don't.
So it would have been really interesting to see that in light of the earlier debate we've kind of mentioned there about whether Paul was kind of coaching him implicitly or not, wouldn't it?
Right, yeah, because Mannion's his demeanor when he testified was so different from what we saw with Paul when he first interviewed him, because he was, you know, he was defensive and angry and flippant, and that when he testified he was just very calm and I don't know, and I you know, it was a completely different demeanor. And either Mannion figured that out himself and he was pretty smart, I think he could have, or he was coached by Paul, hey, this is what the jury wants to see, you've got to give them what they want.
I mean, was there anything else that struck you that like we should have seen, you know, along those lines? Because I mean, the thing is, we spend so much time in the courtroom, don't we, once the trial kicks off, that it's kind of from one witness to the next kind of thing, isn't it?
I thought that, and maybe it's just me because I can picture what's going on in the background, but I thought that the trial really left us, you know, satisfied, or left me satisfied, like knowing how it built up to getting there. We saw the, you know, that he had seen, you know, seen the psychiatrist and what that defense was going to be. We saw a little bit of legal research in the law library, and I, other than pretrial motions, I didn't feel like we were missing anything.
So one of the things that the prosecution do, they have all these other all these other inmates they bring in to testify against Mannion, don't we? And it's so yeah, not impossible to imagine that, I don't know, something was dangled in front of them. You know, you say what we want, and something good will come your way. I mean, presumably that's massively illegal, but that's the sense I got, is what kind of might have gone on behind the scenes here.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And that happens, it happens all the time. I have had so many cases where my client's cellmate is in there to testify that my client said such and such. And I, you know, often it's the person who's behind bars, who's got some experience with the system, who contacts the state, say, or the prosecutor, saying, "Hey, I heard this. Is this going to get me any favorable treatment?" But I think that it goes the other way too. I think the prosecutors question people about, "Have you ever heard the defendant say anything?" So I don't. I think that that's not as illegal or as uncommon as you would think.
So if you so you would say, like, if you say this in court, and your sentence will be, I don't know, so you can actually say, you know, what the outcome will be, like a favorable outcome.
Okay, it has to be, if you come in and testify to the truth, if
Yes,
you
right.
testify truthfully, then we'll make a recommendation on your sentence. Yeah, but the thing is, that has to be disclosed to the defense. Any kind of deal has to be disclosed,
I see.
and the jury hears all about it. So it's not a behind the scenes kind of thing. It happens, but they only ever ask the witness to tell the truth. That's the agreement. Come in and tell us the truth. But then we'll, yeah, you can get favorable deals for doing so.
Okay. Interesting. I'll remember that if I ever need, you know. Right. So what about when I think it's a really gripping sequence, actually, when Laura takes the stand. And you know, there's this thing throughout where the film has the prosecution trying to make certain insinuations about her, and they kind of play off it, don't they, where Jimmy Stewart says, "We can see her hair, you know, and all this stuff," based on the, you know, they talk about the way she dresses and all this. But like, how about when like Dancer questions her? Because he seems to like really get in her face in a way that just seemed excessive to me, really menacing. Yeah, what do you think?
I thought, I just absolutely hated that whole cross-examination scene. It was so uncomfortable. I mean, it was a great scene, but I hated Dancer in that moment. There's no way he should have been that close to her. It was awful. And then the blaming her and insinuating that she, you know, she wasn't a victim in all of this. And you could tell Paul was working. Paul was initially trying to play into that mentality. Well, you're gonna dress as the meek little housewife, and you're not gonna dance, and you're gonna wear a girdle and all that stuff. But then when he saw that the prosecution was going to be blaming her, and then he tried to work with it and saying, "Well, she's a lovely woman, and you know, show your hair." And yeah, that whole scene with the cross-examination of Laura was so hateful. And to me, what I wrote in my notes, it was actually really progressive of this movie to show that as so awful, you know, because the victim blaming still goes on, and it was common back then, but it showed, I thought it was showing it as very unfair, because I believed Laura from the start, and I think we're intended to, and then we get the prosecutor up there being so awful to her. I thought that was really, I was impressed with that scene.
Yeah, I agree, because he's, you know, the way George C. Scott plays it as well, he's so repellent. But yeah, I absolutely, yeah, we're absolutely supposed to be on her side, I think. You're right. So yeah, I mean, the drama kind of piles up, doesn't it, late on in the trial. So we sort of get, I don't know, we get Mannion reappears on the stand, we get the last minute surprise witness, Mary, who we discover to be the daughter of the murdered man, which nobody knew. And I think it's to the film's credit that, I mean, I was a slight, you know, I was aware that I'm being manipulated a bit by all these twists and turns that kind of take place late on, but I never felt like overly manipulated, if that makes sense. What do you think? You think it kind of earned it?
I think that I really liked the way they used Mary's character, because, you know, everyone's gossiping about her, and they're sure they know her, and they're sure they know her motivations, and they're wrong. And I really liked the way that was slowly revealed. And I loved the cross-examination of her, because Dancer breaks the cardinal rule of cross-examination, which is you never ask the witness a question you don't know the answer to. And it lost the case for him. I mean, without that testimony, or without that cross-examination of Mary Plant and him, you know, really blowing it at that moment, I think that the prosecution would have won the case. They'd done enough damage with Laura's cross-examination and with Mannion, and showing that he's just that hothead, and that's really all that happened here. He just got angry and went off and killed a guy. But without making a fool of himself over Mary Plant, they would have won.
So, like, then, yeah, before we get the verdict, though, there's that scene, isn't there, where they're all out, Paul and company, they're out there waiting for the jury to return, and they all seem to kind of handle it slightly differently.
Yeah.
Don't they, though? So I don't know. I've never actually thought about what it must be like for lawyers, kind of just, and I suppose for defendants, you know, just waiting around. You don't know how long you're going to be. Quite a weird situation, I suppose.
What I loved was they were all saying, "What do you think the jury's going to do?" I don't know what I would do. I mean, they were not convinced of their case. It wasn't just, I don't know if we did a good enough job. It was just like, I don't really know what happened. And I thought that was pretty realistic, because as much as movies try to show, and with this movie, they never showed anything that happened before Paul took the case. They didn't show what really happened with Barney and Laura and Mannion. So just to be, for them to say, for Maida to say, if I were on the jury, I don't know what I would do, when she's on the defense team, I thought was really, really good portrayal of what it's like to do criminal law. And I'm sorry, I forgot what your question was.
Just like how it's kind of a weird situation, you know, that you sort of, it's indeterminate, isn't it? You don't know whether you're going to be there for half an hour or, I don't know, in some films it's like days, isn't it, you know?
Right, yeah, the jury could deliberate for days and days. And it's kind of interesting with this older movies how they're deliberating into the night. And these days the jury would be sent home and told to come back at 9 a.m. But it does make for more drama when they get a call in the middle of the night saying the jury's ready.
Yeah. So what about the verdict itself? So I suppose there's whether the right verdict was returned, and there's whether you think he actually was insane, or whatever they say, whether he actually did have an irresistible impulse, because there might be two slightly different answers, mightn't they, depending on, I know we talk about the burden of proof or whatever, but so what's your feeling?
Yeah, I'm really, and this one's much closer for me. There are a lot of times where I watch a case and think, well, I think the guy probably did it, but the state sure didn't prove its case, so the verdict was correct. And with this one, I don't know. I mean, I don't have a feeling. I sort of feel like Mannion made up the whole irresistible impulse. Yeah. I guess I do have a feeling about that. So maybe the verdict was wrong. But as for whether the prosecution proved that, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and that's what's so great about it, isn't it? That we're not dealing with, I mean, we sit through 2.5 hours. We're not, by the end of it, we're not dealing in certainties.
Right.
And yet we're not feeling kind of cheated by this. Instead, it's kind of thought-provoking, isn't it? You know, I think it's really well handled, actually.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the more interesting parts about this movie, is you come away from it not really knowing.
All right, so I had a few comments from people online, Kathy, but before we read those, so was there anything else? Because I know it's a long film, there are lots of scenes, so we have kind of skipped over bits and pieces. Was there anything else that kind of really struck you about this?
Irresistible impulse. I did check into that. That's sadly not a defense in Washington. Legal insanity is you lacked the ability to tell right from wrong, and that's what they were getting at with the prosecutor. You know, they kept asking those questions, but could he have told right from wrong? And the psychiatrist said, well, it didn't matter, he was acting on an irresistible impulse. But there are actually cases that say that is not a defense. If you're legally insane, it's only because you couldn't tell right from wrong. And then if you're legally insane, you don't just get to walk out of the courtroom. You get to be committed and treated for insanity. So yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Right. So we had a comment from Maddie. Maddie loves her classic films is her Twitter handle. So she said, love it. One of the best courtroom films ever made. Lee Remick, James Stewart and George C. Scott at their best. Love the friendship between Paul, Parnell, and Maida. I like how we really get to make up our minds about what did or did not happen to Laura. So yeah, if people want to come back to us with their thoughts on the verdict, please do, because yeah, it is really interesting. Max Barrill said, I'm a huge fan. I also have an episode of Movie Musts podcast coming out on it. So yeah, if people want to check out, it's the classic Movie Musts podcast. By the time this episode is released, I think they will have already posted theirs. So should be out if people want to go and check that out too. So that sounds fascinating. Raquel Stetcher said, it's so provocative and what a great role for Jimmy Stewart. This is one of many films that demonstrated Otto Preminger's chops as a director and that he could tackle pretty much any subject matter. So yeah, Preminger did a lot of great stuff. So last one we could pick up a bit more on, because I think we kind of touched on this, but Tim Rosenberger says, one thing I find most interesting about the movie is that if you really look at his character, Jimmy Stewart is not playing a likable guy. He's rather slimy. The only reason I think audiences, including me, take to him is because he's played by Jimmy Stewart. So, yeah, I don't know if you flip the roles or something, if you'd had George C. Scott as the defense attorney and Jimmy Stewart as the prosecutor, but they did exactly the same things, how would we look at it differently? Do you know what I mean? I think a lot of it is Stewart's kind of appeal, you know.
I mean, we did talk about the ethical questions with him coaching his client, but I think a lot of people tend to see defense attorneys as slimy because they're representing someone who could be guilty, whereas that's what 98% of defense attorneys do, and it doesn't make them slimy. It's just that's the role that everyone's entitled to a zealous defense, because if he doesn't get it, then he could be locked up inappropriately. So I don't know that I would call Paul Bigler slimy.
Slimy is a strong word, I think.
Yeah, I would definitely call Dancer slimy, and I think I have several times as we're talking. But yeah, that is, it's a really good question, and the way you flipped it and said, well, if Jimmy Stewart was playing Dancer, would I have liked him more? I know.
I'm trying to think about famous lawyers here from films, and like, so Atticus Finch, was he a defense?
Yeah.
Oh, so you've had some good fictional role models there for the defense, I suppose.
We all see ourselves as Atticus Finch.
Last comment then. So Hedonism Incorporated, great name, said, loved Duke Ellington's cameo. So yeah, if anyone goes away and watches this film now, so yeah, Duke Ellington playing the piano alongside Jimmy Stewart in the bar at one point. So yeah, look out for that. Great stuff. All right, Kathy, yes, it's been an absolute pleasure, as ever. So yeah, if people want to, I don't know, find you on Twitter or whatever, where are you? Where are you online?
I am Kathy G on Twitter, and I never remember what the at part is. Sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. I think you're at Catherine Glynn's 2.
Okay, that sounds right.
That sounds about right, yeah. So yeah, people can find Kathy there. You can find the podcast in all the usual places, so mainly on Twitter, at MoviePalacePod, but also Facebook, Instagram. You know, if you're looking at iTunes, if you want to leave us a review, that'd be awesome. But I hope you can join me next time, listeners, when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.